Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Maxwell's House is brought to you by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Maxwell's House with Ray Maxwell and Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode number 76, Landing on Water.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Maxwell's House. It's episode number 76, Landing on Water. I'm Dr. Kiki, and in the house, well, actually on Skype in his own house, is Ray Maxwell.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
I'm doing just fine.
I'm highly caffeinated and full of interesting conversations, so I'm a little bouncy. It's a good thing I've got the ball today.
Well, we're gonna cover a whole lot of things, and we're gonna cover a little bit of news. We're gonna go through some questions from our listeners, and then we're gonna talk about the main topic: landing on water. This is gonna be float flying. How does it differ from normal flying? And I'll tell you some stories about my adventures flying floats.
I'm excited to hear it. Today is the adventure day on TWiT. So
yes,
lots of adventure in the news. So what better day to talk about the adventures you've had float flying? What's in the news?
Well, the first thing, the really big news in the aerospace community today has to do with the successful launch of the Falcon 9.
Yeah,
which is a private enterprise space launch that successfully made it to orbit. This is from a company called SpeedX, and the founder of this company is a person very well known in the high-tech field.
Elon Musk,
and he is the founder or one of the founders of PayPal. He's also the man behind Tesla Motors, and of course, with regard to this, the company SpeedX, which is a private company that intends to... actually, it has bid on sending materials to the space station for the U.S. government instead of NASA doing it. And, of course, we know that NASA is shutting down the shuttles. And so here is a private firm taking a shot at taking over, doing transfers of both men and materials. There is a module that will carry people that can be attached to the Falcon 9. It is scalable. It can carry different loads depending upon the first stage rockets that they attach to it. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this works out. Now, this is right in line with some of the announcements that Barack Obama made with regard to privatizing some of the space efforts in an effort to make it more efficient. Of course, that's a controversial topic, and we'll see how it all works out.
Yeah, well, one of the issues that's been brought up as well is not just the ending of the space shuttle program, but also the ending of the Constellation program. So stopping the development by the government of our the replacement for the shuttle. So
right.
A company like, and it gets closed down, you see SpeedX and the Falcon 9 succeed, and if they are able to develop a human transport vehicle that could be, be a replacement in the meantime for the next stage of space work by the government and by other private organizations, that might be a direction that, you know, as things work in the private sector, we might be seeing more and more of... or I guess more and more NASA programs being shut down.
Exactly.
And of course, is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea?
Right. And it depends on who you ask. Yeah. If you ask Neil Armstrong, he's very upset over the whole thing. There are other people cheering it on. So we're just going to have to wait and see. The other controversial topic that's been brought up at a number of sessions lately that and Elon and the other guys have some opinions on that. It is how soon and will we go to Mars?
Tomorrow.
You know, unfortunately, going to Mars is a much, much more complicated thing than going to the moon. And the thing that makes it more
slightly more complicated
is not just the length of the trip or the time that it takes or anything like that, but you go through some areas of space with extremely high radiation.
Yeah.
And so far, they have not figured out a way
to shield
humans from that radiation that is viable. You either have to have a lead-lined spaceship or you have to have it surrounded by water. All of these things are extremely heavy, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to carry those along. There's possibilities of some electrical shields, plasma discharges around the ship, and I've heard all kinds of things. But you know where I think it might go, and I, you know, it will take some time.
Where's that?
But as we know, there are biological species on this planet that are resistant to radiation. I can't remember the name of it. A friend of mine studies this. He was telling me about when they irradiate food to sterilize it. There is one creature that when its DNA is disturbed, it automatically rebuilds its DNA correctly and is not harmed by the radiation. And so my far-fetched suggestion for how we send men to Mars.
Did you make a biofilm?
No.
To cover the entire ship?
No, we genetically engineer the humans to be resistant to radiation.
Oh, perfect. I think our DNA is a little bit bigger. Our genome's slightly larger than that.
Who knows what genetic engineering is going to bring in, you know.
Yeah, we have no idea. I mean, but in terms of the going to Mars and getting there, we have huge technical challenges still to overcome to be able to do it, but they've stuck people in, in their experiment to actually find out how they work together. It's an all male crew that they've chosen and put into isolation, and they're going to be isolated for the period of time that it would take, conceivably, for a trip to Mars. Yeah. So they're going to be looking at the psychological issues, what happens in isolation, how people handle various issues. They're going to run them through different scenarios. And even once you get to Mars, then there's still the question of what do you do once you're there?
Right.
And what can we do once we're there? I mean, we have a ship that maybe can land, that can be home base, but then how do you get back? Do you stay there? How long can you exist there? Mars, because it doesn't have an atmosphere, gets way more radiation than Earth does. So you're dealing with radiation the whole time you're there.
Do you carry enough fuel to get back, or do you manufacture the fuel when you reach Mars? Because there's probes on Mars that are studying that possibility of manufacturing the fuel after you get there.
Or is it something that people volunteer for that's a one-way trip?
Right.
I mean, is that okay? Yeah. Is that okay as human society? Is that okay for our Mars-a-fest destiny, you know, to allow that? Say, okay, this is a one-way trip. You're going to go.
Right.
You're going to start setting things up.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's at least one state that allows us to decide when we terminate ourselves. Anyway, we better not go off on that one. Okay, let me get to our questions this week. And first, I have to cover some errata. That's known as Ray made a boo-boo.
Uh-oh.
Say it isn't so, Ray. Yeah, someone asked me how they number runways, and I got it all right, except I happened to pick out what if the runway, what if your magnetic heading is due north when you're landing, and I called it runway 00, and that is not correct. It is runway 36. Of course, you know, they're one and the same, but on your compass, it says 360. So runway 36 is due north. The other mistake I made, and it was just a slip of my tongue, I was telling about hot air balloons and how much heat their burners could produce, that the balloon I had, which was a relatively small balloon, could produce 18 million BTU. And I said the average house had a 500,000 BTU furnace. That's not correct. It's less than that. It's typically 50 to 150,000 BTU. So it's even a bigger, jump to go to the hot air balloon heater. That's 18 million versus a typical furnace in a home that's 50 to 150,000 BTU. So I meant to say 50,000 and I said 500,000, which was incorrect. Now, the next question was, a person asked me, he said he keeps hearing the term related to flying, pilot in command. And he said, what does pilot in command mean? And if the pilot in command is the one who can log the time, what about the co-pilot or first officer in an airliner? Can he log the time as well? And pilot in command means the person who, in the final analysis, is responsible for the flight of the aircraft. And so if two of us get in a plane and we're both licensed to fly that plane, before we take off, we have to decide who is pilot in command. Now, that doesn't mean that the pilot in command is the one manipulating the controls, but we have to decide for insurance and liability and regulations and so forth, we have to decide who is the pilot in command. And if I'm checking out a new pilot in a glider and we're both licensed, then we have to decide, am I advising him in checking him out in the new aircraft and he's pilot in command, or am I pilot in command and responsible for the aircraft? And it's a decision that can be made amongst the pilots, but we have to basically state what it is before we leave the ground. And a first officer or co-pilot, you log the time as first officer time or co-pilot time, and you get credit for that time as well. So that's pilot in command. And then, oh, I must have gotten a half a dozen emails or more because I made a statement that the pseudo instruments in the iPhone and on the iPad now use the accelerometers, and they're not to be used as real instruments in an aircraft because they are accelerometers and they are not gyros. Well, guess what was announced about the iPhone 4?
What's that?
The iPhone 4 has gyros in it.
That's exciting.
Yes.
How interesting.
So then that immediately begs the question, can I use the iPhone 4 as a backup instrument in an aircraft? And I would have to say you certainly can't use it as a certified instrument, or it hasn't been approved yet. And we're going to have to test it and look into it and see how accurate and how stable and whether it can set itself up properly before you take off, and then how long it takes it to drift and a whole lot of other factors. But at least the correct technology is on board that would allow you to build or, you know, have an app that gives you a pseudo artificial horizon. But I'm not about to say, go for it.
Will you volunteer to be one of the first iPhone gyroscope test pilots?
Well, first of all, I have to get my hands on an iPhone 4. And since Canada was late to get the 3GS and, got them about a year late, about 6 months ago, I signed a 3-year contract for my iPhone 3GS. So I'm probably not going to trade up to a iPhone 4 anytime soon. So we'll see. But I might get my hands on one. Somebody in the club, the glider club, may get one. And if we do, we're going to be sure and try it out.
But you're going to make sure that you have a backup plan.
Absolutely. Oh, no. I'm not taking one of those up and depending. We will test it in VFR conditions. We will test it with other backup instruments fully functioning. Absolutely.
Good.
Then another question I got was, have I ever attended Oshkosh, the EAA Air Venture, which is one of the biggest gatherings of the Experimental Aircraft Association? And I have not attended that yet. I would like to. I have no immediate plans to do so, but I do hope one of these days I can get out. But I got a number of questions on that. And then finally, I got a question on a big raging debate. And this raging debate is, how do airfoils work? In other words, the shape of an airplane's wing, how does it produce lift? And classically, up until a few years ago, it was always explained using Bernoulli's principle, and that the path over the top of the wing was longer than the path under the wing, and therefore the air had to accelerate to a higher velocity.
And change in pressure.
Air that is at a higher velocity is lower pressure. The air under the wing is at a higher pressure, and that creates lift. Now, more recently, there's the angle of attack school that says, hey, even if you take a piece of plywood, you hold it at the correct angle of attack, it may not be the most efficient airfoil, but it does produce lift. And there's varying debates about whether that still is a longer path over the top, or if it's caused by action, Newton's laws of action versus reaction. And I would say that the truth of the matter is that there's really two ways of looking at this. You can look at this from the point of view of an aeronautical engineer, and you can look at this from the point of a pilot. So let's take the aeronautical engineer first.
An aeronautical engineer is never going to build a plane with a 2x4 as a wing.
Who knows? They're probably going to choose some very carefully selected airfoil that's been tested in a wind tunnel. But to model it, they do have very sophisticated models. And how it behaves depends on the speed. A very low-speed wing, like on a glider, behaves very differently from a jet that's flying at Mach 2. And you get into Mach speeds, you have a totally different model of what's happening. It depends on the density. A wing behaves very differently at sea level than it does at 40,000 feet. In addition, a thing that model airplane builders are very aware of, and people who try and model new aircraft in a wind tunnel, is a thing called Reynolds numbers. Because let's say you build a scale model of an aircraft and you want to, you know, test it in a wind tunnel or actually fly it as a model aircraft. If you do so, you know, let's say you make it 1/4 scale. In other words, all the dimensions of the airplane are 1/4 the real thing. There's one problem you have, and that is that the air that you're flying it in, the density of it and its behavior, viscosity and so forth, does not scale. You're still flying in real air. And so what you have to do is you have to apply Reynolds numbers, which is a way to model. In other words, you can take the behavior of the model and then scale up that behavior to full size using Reynolds numbers. It's not a simple model, and there's no real quick way, but they do have various kinds of computer models of wings and fuselages and everything else that are available. But they are not simple models. They're not just action-reaction, and they're not just Bernoulli's principle. They're always more complicated than that. Now, from the point of view of a pilot, though, I think you can simplify this. The thing you can say, the thing you worry the most about as a pilot is, what are the stall characteristics of the aircraft? And those are, regardless of the wing shape and so forth, angle of attack is the name of the game. At a certain angle of attack, a certain kind of airfoil will separate, buffet, and stall. And this doesn't happen at one speed, but it does happen at one angle of attack. It depends on the loading. It depends on the G-forces. Also, there are some wings that buffet before they stall and give the pilot lots of warning. That's always good. And there are some that break very suddenly and give very little warning. And there are some that will break straight ahead, and there are others that will drop one wing. It's very hard to tune the aircraft so that they break straight ahead, and you'll get a sudden wing drop. So those are the things that a pilot needs to know about the lift characteristics of the plane that they're flying, and then fly accordingly. So you have to also know things like how does rain affect the airfoil? There's a number of high-performance gliders that when it rains and the wing gets wet, it changes the behavior of the aircraft considerably, markedly. And, of course, we did a whole show on icing, and icing affects different wings differently. And those are the kinds of characteristics that a pilot needs to know about rather than an aeronautical engineer. And with that, that covers the questions for this week. And we'll get into our main topic, which is flying float aircraft.
Yay. And
I have to say that I've always said that if they, you know, would only let me fly one kind of airplane, it would be a sailplane, and that's a glider, because you are really working, you know, you're really tuned in to your surroundings and the environment you're in, and it's mostly silent flight, and it's just a beautiful thing. But my second choice would probably be float flying, and it's not because of the flight characteristics of the float planes, because they're really like a, well, they're more like a Mack truck or a, you know, the sailplanes are like sailboats or sports cars. They're, you really handle them with finesse and you really get tuned into your surroundings. The float plane, on the other hand, is usually a high powered aircraft, and it's more brute strength and awkwardness to flying it than it is fine finesse. But at any rate, let me tell you a little bit about the characteristics of most float planes. Now, I had a Cessna 185 on floats, and I have about 500 hours total time on floats. I have about 2,800 in all kinds of aircraft. And the characteristics of a float plane are quite interesting. First of all, when you learn to fly a land plane, you are taught how to do what's known as a soft field takeoff and landing. And this would be a grass field or a muddy field. And the truth of the matter is the techniques you use with a float plane are very much like the techniques you use on a land plane when you're landing or taking off from what's referred to as a soft field. So the secret when you take off in a float plane, you pull this wheel all the way back. So you want to pull the nose up to the maximum angle of attack right away. And you also have to, you're doing two things. You're dealing with the air and you're dealing with the water simultaneously. And so your floats are a high-speed hull, a water hull, that has a step. In other words, the main part of the float, the forward part, is fairly bulbous and large. And it goes back about halfway along the float, and then there's a step where it steps up, and then the back part of the float is much slimmer and trimmer, and the bottom steps up. And what you want to do is, as you're taking off, is rock the plane slowly forward so that you get the minimum wetted area. I mean, when you start out, the floats are displacing the weight of, they're displacing water that's equal to the weight of the airplane. And as you start skimming across the water, it slowly climbs up. You pull back on the stick and you push the nose over and it gets up on what's known as getting on the step. And there's an optimum attitude at which you will accelerate and minimize the wetted area on the bottom of the float. And that's what you're trying to do. And you can feel it as you apply full throttle, bring the nose over, and get on the step. There's an attitude that if you pull back, you'll dig in the heel of the float and slow down. If you push forward too much, the front of the float will start digging into the water. And you'll feel that, and that will slow you down. So there's an optimum attitude. And then the floats are attached to the plane such that if you have 20 degrees of flaps on, the wings will start producing their maximum amount of lift at the same attitude as where you can accelerate the quickest when you're on the step. So the secret is finding that attitude and holding it. And the other thing that's unique about the float plane is you can't rush the takeoff. Until in the Cessna 185 case, the airspeed indicator in my plane read in miles per hour. And until I achieved 55 miles an hour airspeed, there was no sense in pulling back on the wheel to lift off the water. It wouldn't come off the water until you had achieved 55 miles an hour. So there was, you know, no rushing it at all. You pull it up into that optimum attitude where it was accelerating and on the step and hold that perfect attitude. And then you'd start glancing at the airspeed. And when you got 55 miles an hour, you could ease back just a little bit and it would pop free of the water. Now, as soon as it gets free of the water, it will accelerate very quickly because that wetted area on the floats is creating a lot of drag. And the other thing that I point out again is in the Cessna 185 case, you had to have 20 degrees of flaps out. If you didn't have the flaps out and you had reached that speed, you would not lift off. And what you'd do is you'd pull back on the stick and you'd dig in the heels and you'd slow down and, you know, you're just not going anywhere. So you do essentially a soft field takeoff every time. Now, landing is another special trick. You land at the very same speed. The ideal landing speed was 55 miles an hour, where you would come down and you would contact the water at that exact same attitude where the minimum wetted area would be touching the floats. And then you'd ease off the power and pull back on the stick, and you'd settle back into the water and slow yourself down. So it's very critical that you take off and land at the right attitude and right airspeed that gives you that attitude. And if you try and rush it, it just takes a lot longer to get off the water. And likewise, if you come down for a landing and you try and fly it on at a speed higher than 55, it's very easy to flip the float plane. And if you want to see a picture of that,
I've got it all set up, actually. I've got a YouTube video.
This is a very experienced pilot, but he's not experienced in flying float planes. This is Art Scholl flying this airplane, who's a famous air show pilot. Go ahead and run this video. He's coming down, and he tries to fly it on, and he touches one float early, and the aircraft rocks back and forth. And then flips over nose first.
Ooh.
And that's what happens if you try and fly a float plane on and you don't have it slowed down enough. If you notice, it catches on the front portion of the pontoons and gives it a pitching forward motion when it hits the water and then finally goes over. And it was quite funny. This was not in the script of the movie. They didn't plan this.
But it happened.
And by the way, this happened in a lake I have flown into. This was shot near Vancouver. And it happens in a lake that I used to fly into. And the name of the lake is Lake Lovely Water.
Lovely to crash a plane into water.
Right. Now, I had a copy of the accident report done by Transport Canada. And I love the final comment in it, because what they had done is a regular float pilot, a local one, had flown in the film crew to film this aircraft landing on this beautiful lake. And they weren't expecting this accident, but Art Scholl, who only had 10 hours on floats, according to the report at the time, and by the way, that's very minimal experience on floats, he flew to the back of this lake and then tried to fly it down and rush it onto the water before he could slow down enough. And then he touched the front part of the floats, and that's what caused it to flip. Well, he tried to say by the way, the producer was and star was Charlton Heston, and the producer was Charlton Heston's son. And he tried to say they had paid him to crash the airplane. But that was not the truth, according to all the local pilots that I talked to. And they got another local float pilot to do the rest of the float flying for the movie. Now, please understand that Art was a very experienced and very good air show pilot. He used to fly a de Havilland Chipmunk in a lot of the local air shows. And sadly, he was killed when flying a highly aerobatic airplane in the making of Top Gun off Catalina Island. Huh. And he got into an inverted flat spin because of the weight of the camera gear on the plane he was flying. And he said on the radio, fellas, I think I'm in trouble. And, you know, had time to say what was, you know, wrong. And and went in and was killed in the accident. But he was a very highly experienced pilot. He had over 8,000 hours total time and had flown in air shows for years. And I used to love to watch him fly in the air shows. But he made the mistake of checking out in floats very quickly and not getting a lot of experience before he had this accident. And by the way, he wasn't hurt at all in this accident. That's one of the beauties of a float accident. The energy is usually spread over a long distance. And
so it's not quite as devastating a crash as, say, just landing on the earth.
Exactly. So at any rate, if you want to find this, do a search in the movies on YouTube and search for the movie Motherload, L-O-D-E, Motherload, and you'll find that movie on YouTube, and you can watch it. And if you check very carefully, you can see what happens, that he flips it. Any rate, just so you know, I have landed in that lake, but I had, I don't know, I must have had 100 hours on floats before I ever went to that lake. I talked to all the local pilots and got their advice on how to land in that lake, because it's a small, high-altitude lake. And I went to that lake four times looking for the right wind conditions before I went in, and I didn't land there until the fourth time. You know, and I went three times and said, no, things are not right, and left the area. And now once you had been into it once and you knew, you know, you really had a feel for the whole thing, it wasn't that hard to go in and out of it. And I went out in and out many times after that. But it was what we call a one-way lake. It was a little lake above Squamish in the Tantalus Mountain Range. It was about 3,000 feet above sea level. And you had to fly in and land coming in over a waterfall. And there was no going around. It was in a steep canyon that if you didn't land and went on, there was no way to exit the area. It was fairly narrow and small. You might be able to turn around very sharply and get out. But you never planned it. And so you had to approach it. I always approached the waterfall at a 45-degree angle and then made my final decision to turn and go in and land or to pull away from it and leave the area. And then you had to take off the other way regardless of the wind. And so what I always like to do is have a gentle wind blowing into the lake so I had a wind on my nose when I was flying out. Because let me point out again that flying floats, you need a lot of area, and most of the areas you flew into, which were rivers and lakes, were big, long runways, you know, for you. So when you get into really high-altitude lakes, your landing distance and takeoff distance starts to change very radically. Your landing distance doesn't change much. In other words, whether you're landing at sea level or whether you're landing in a high-altitude lake 5,000 feet up, the landing, typically I could land in as little as 500 feet, let's say. So you could land pretty short. But at 5,000 feet, the engine won't develop full power unless you have a turbocharged airplane. And the Cessna 185 I had, although it had a 300-horsepower engine, would only develop a little over half of its power coming out of a 5,000-foot lake. And so it would take more like 3,000, 4,000, or 5,000 feet to take off on a hot day. So you could land in 500, and you'd need 5,000, you know, 10 to 1. So you were very careful when you went into high-altitude lakes to be sure that you had enough room to take off. you could land, no problem, but you might not be able to get off.
And then you would be completely stuck somewhere in the mountains with no way out.
And it's happened. Guys have flown airplanes that aren't, you know, right for a high altitude lake and landed. And then they've had to come in and lift the plane out with a turbine, high altitude helicopter.
Oh, my gosh.
To deal with that. Of course, that costs you thousands of dollars.
But it would be better to pay for the getting out of there as opposed to having to walk out or starving to death in a high altitude lake in the mountains.
And that brings up another thing. What do you have to do to be prepared to do float flying? And one of the things is you have to be prepared to take care of yourself, because one of the things you'll do if you have a float plane is you'll want to fly into high altitude lakes in the middle of nowhere. And so for many years, we used to go up to Southeast Alaska, and I'll tell a little more about that. But when you go into those places, you have to file a flight plan or flight itinerary so that if you don't come back out, they will send in somebody to search for you. But if you're planning on going into one of these cabins for 3 days and you have an accident going in, there's not going to be anybody looking for you until you're overdue coming back out. So in the meantime, you have to have all the necessary survival gear, sleeping bags, tent, food, a rifle, and other kinds of survival equipment to take care of yourself, because nobody's going to, you know, take care of you in the meantime. So you have to be carrying all the equipment you're going to need to survive until somebody comes after you if you're overdue. The other things that help you prepare to be a good float pilot, and I was lucky in having both of these, I had taken sailing courses and had learned to sail a boat, and that will help you in maneuvering on the water and understanding how a float plane will react when there's a wind blowing or there's a current. When you're trying to dock, it's very tricky. Float planes do not have any brakes. And most float planes, there are a few, but most float planes don't have any reverse. So when you're coming in to dock, you come in, and when you're about 20 feet from the dock, or sometimes further, depending on the winds and the conditions, you kill the engine, and then you drift in, and then you jump out onto the float, and then you jump out onto the dock, and you pull the plane into the dock and then tie it up. But that can be very tricky. You only get one chance, is what I'm saying. If you blow it,
you're in the water.
You're in the water. And almost every float plane pilot, including myself, has gone for a swim at least once.
Not on purpose?
No.
An intentional swim?
Well, in my case, I was flying down to San Juan Island, and I was going into... or Orcas. I guess it was San Juan. I was going into Friday Harbor, and I was clearing customs there. I was flying from Canada into the U.S. in our float plane. And I had to go into the float plane dock. And it was a real tricky dock in that day the wind was blowing directly offshore. So I had to come in, and I cut the engine, and I cut it just a little bit too quickly. I jumped down on the float. I grabbed the strut underneath the wing, and I swung my feet onto the dock. Well, my heels went over the edge of the dock, and I tried to get the rest of my weight onto the dock, and the plane started blowing backwards away from the dock. So I'm holding the plane, you know, with my hands, and my heels are just barely on the dock. And the customs agent who was meeting me is he's about 100 yards away, but he's coming down the dock, and I hear him start to laugh because he can see the handwriting on the wall, and it all happened in super slow motion. And so, any rate, at the last second, when I knew I wasn't going to make it, I let go of the strut and grabbed the float with one hand and the dock with the other, but of course, I went into the water up to my waist, and so... He came down, you know, came running down the dock and grabbed the strut of the plane, pulled it in, and I climbed on the float and climbed on the dock. And I spent the next hour in a laundromat wearing my bathing suit while the rest of my clothes were in a dryer. And by the way, I can tell you a story just like that on almost every float pilot I know.
It's like a hazing that you have to go through at least once.
That's right. It's not a question of if, you know, it's a question of if you're going to do it. It's a question of when it's going to happen to you, because sooner or later you're going to have it. But I tell you what, the beauty of the float plane is it got my wife and I and many of our friends into some most beautiful areas that you could possibly go to. I mean, we lived in the city of Vancouver, you know, which is a million people. And we could jump in our float plane and we could fly off into the mountains. And within 30 minutes flying distance from Vancouver, we had six lakes we could reach in 30 minutes. And every one of those lakes, we rarely saw another human being unless they had flown in a float plane, because most of these lakes were not accessible even to hikers. I mean, there weren't any trails into them. And so we could go into these beautiful, beautiful areas, have them all to ourselves, and just have a wonderful time. And then one of our really big adventures is twice we took our float plane and we flew up to Southeast Alaska. And Southeast Alaska is heaven for a float plane pilot. And let me explain why. The Forest Service in Southeast Alaska used to have 128 cabins in between Juneau and Ketchikan, Alaska. And back when we had our float plane, you could rent these cabins from the Forest Service. You could rent them for $5 a night. Now, I think the price is still like $20 or $25 a night even today. And these cabins have a rowboat. They usually have cut firewood. You have to bring your own food and sleeping bag and so forth. But at least 75 or 80% of these cabins are only reachable by float plane. There's no trail into them. There's nobody around. Most of them are high-altitude lakes in the middle of nowhere. And they're in some of the most scenic areas in all of Southeast Alaska, including some of the parks. Our first night flying up, and by the way, you can stay 3 days in a cabin, then you have to move on, but you have to reserve these cabins at least 6 months in advance. So you have to, you know, right on 6 months of when you plan to go, you want to get your reservation in and send your money in so you can reserve these. But if you have your own float plane, they're just wonderful. Now, you can charter a float plane to drop you in as well to these Forest Service cabins in Southeast Alaska. But our first time in, we flew from Vancouver up to Sullivan Bay, which is the north end of Vancouver Island. And then we flew nonstop from there to Ketchikan, Alaska, and cleared customs. And then that evening, we flew out to a place called Big Goat Lake. And it's in the middle of the Misty Fjords National Monument, which is a beautiful, beautiful, deep fjord. And you fly up to the end of the fjord and you turn down another side fjord and you see this beautiful waterfall coming out of this high mountain lake. And you fly over the waterfall and land in this high mountain lake. And there's a little peninsula jutting out into the lake. And you park your plane there, and there's a cabin on the end of this peninsula. And this is your cabin. And there's a little rowboat tied up there. And the first night we were there, we thought we'd died and gone to heaven. We tied up the plane and unloaded our supplies into the cabin and then went out for a row in the rowboat. And we found out why they called it Big Goat Lake, because all around us, we were surrounded by mountains. Lakes are always in valleys for some reason. And we were surrounded by mountains that went up 4,000 or 5,000 feet. And we could see mountain goats playing in the mountains. And it was just gorgeous. And we stayed up there 3 weeks. And every 3 days, we went to a new cabin, new lake, new scenery, and just had the time of our lives. Now, on top of that, the people in Southeast Alaska were some of the friendliest people I've ever encountered. Some special places that we went. We went into Juneau, Alaska. We got weathered in there for a couple of days, and one of the guys that ran a fixed base operation there overheard me checking the weather, and he said, "You're stuck here for a day or two, and if you want, you can sleep in our offices upstairs." And so he said, "Are you staying in Forest Service cabins?" And we said, "Yes." And he said, "Fine." He said, "Bring in your sleeping bags, and you can stay here. And oh, by the way, we'll loan you one of our cars so you can go into town." And so we took them for dinner that night, met them, had a wonderful visit with them, and stayed there for a day or two until the weather cleared, and then went on to our next cabin. But they were so nice to take us in. And the same thing in the people at Petersburg, Alaska. We stopped in there for fuel, and I went into the office at the floatplane dock and introduced myself. And they said, help yourself to anything. Just the gas is out there on finger pier number one. Help yourself to gasoline. The oil is over here. The fuel oil for your cabins are at the next dock down here. The fish are biting in such and such a lake. They just took us in like we were long lost relatives. And they said, just take whatever you need. And when you've got it all loaded in your plane, come tell us what you've taken. And then you can pay for it. In other words, this is entirely on a trust system.
That's amazing.
And they were just wonderful people. Always kept us informed what was happening in the area, where the best fishing was, where the best sightseeing was, and so forth. The same thing with Ketchikan. We met a number of float pilots there and had a wonderful time. And we went back there twice, and both times we had a wonderful stay in Southeast Alaska and the Forest Service cabins. Now, to wind things up today, I'm going to tell one more story. I was working for McDonald Detweiler and Associates here in Vancouver when I had the float plane, and I was working on a satellite ground station for the Israeli Air Force. This is a weather satellite ground station. And when we got near the end of this project, a general, a very high-ranking general, came to Vancouver, and he was to inspect the work that we had done and sign off, on the final inspection. So I found out he was a pilot, and I said, "Hey," I said, "while you're here in Vancouver, would you like to go flying with me? I have my own plane." And at first he wasn't in. He said, "Oh, I've flown Cessnas." He said, "I'm a jet pilot. I fly fighters and, I fly, all kinds of exotic aircraft." And I said, "Well, yeah, but have you ever flown one that lands on water?" He says, "You mean you've got a float plane?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "No, I've never done that." And so he changed his mind, decided he wanted to go flying with me. So I took him out to one of the lakes and I let him fly the plane, talked as an instructor. I talked him through a couple of landings and takeoffs. And by the way, people get a kick out of this. When you take land planes out, you call and you practice landings and takeoffs and you don't stop, you call it a touch and go. Well, in a float plane, we call it you splash and dash. Okay? So you come down, touch the water. As soon as you've touched the water, you apply a throttle and take off again. So instead of touch and go, it's splash and dash. Anyway, we did a couple of splash and dashes, and he did a very good job of flying it. And then I took him up to a high mountain lake that had a beautiful turquoise water in it, and it had glaciers coming right down to the water and mountains all around it. And it's one of the most beautiful places on Earth. At any rate, he was so taken with it. He said, "Oh, this is so beautiful." And he made a joke about, if God had only made Canada the promised land, the world would be a different place,
Absolutely different.
Yeah. And he went on and on about how beautiful Canada was and how beautiful it was to see it from a float plane and so forth. So at any rate, I thought, I have really done something good here. I've gotten this military man, this man that thinks about wars and all this sort of stuff, and I've got him, totally absorbed with the beauty of the mountains and lakes of Canada. So at any rate, we came back to the Vancouver International Airport, landed in the river, we're putting the plane away, got in my car, and we were driving out of the airport. And again, I'm thinking, boy, I really got this guy, I really got his mind off of war and stuff. And we're driving along the dike where which is right by the river that we had just landed in. And he's looking out, and he's still talking about the beauty of Canada and stuff, and flying in the float plane and how much he enjoyed it. And then he looks out, and he says, tell me something. He said, let me get this right. Anywhere there's water, a mile of water, you can land that float plane. And I said, yes, that's right. And he said, and they can't bomb your runway. Think about that.
There you go.
You can't bomb the runway if it's made of water. So I got his mind a little bit off of war, but I had never thought about float flying in terms of the runway being safe from being bombed. So any rate.
It's all about how you think about it. It's the perspective, right?
That's right. You have to have, you know, gives you a different perspective, I guess, if you live in the Middle East.
Exactly.
Great. It's an experience I will never forget. Anyway, that's going to wrap it up for today. And next week, I'm going to talk in general about things you need to know and things you might want to do to prepare if you want to learn to fly. And I'm going to talk about what is hard about learning to fly and what's easy in learning to fly. And I get all kinds of questions about, you know, does a flight simulator help me learn to fly? How much does it help? Will it cut down the time it takes for me to learn to fly? Things like that. I'm going to discuss those things in detail next week. That's what we'll be discussing next week. If you want to learn to fly, what are some of the things you ought to think about before you take up flying as a hobby or a profession?
Pretty good, because often people don't know what they need to think about. They just say, I want to fly. And yeah, so good. Give people food for thought.
Yeah.
Something to work on. Thank you so much, Ray. Where can people get in touch with you if they have questions to ask you for those wonderful questions
you answered? If they'd like to ask me questions that we answered at the first part of the show, they can write me at Ray, R-A-Y, at twit.tv, TWIT.tv. So it's Ray at twit.tv.
Fantastic. And I am Dr. Kiki, and this has been Maxwell's House. Stay tuned for next week when you'll get all sorts of wonderful information for those of you who are interested in learning how to fly, who want to take to the air like birds in the sky. And there will be much more to come. Ray, this has been a fabulous, fabulous show. Thank you once again for entertaining stories and lots of information. And I probably won't be flying a float plane anytime soon after watching that crash.
Well, if you learn the right techniques, there's no problem.
All right. Well, say goodbye, Ray. It's the end of the show.
Bye, everyone, and look forward to talking to you next week.
We definitely do. You can find more episodes of Maxwell's House at twit.tv/house.
M-H.
It's at the bottom. It's my lower third here. I don't know. I always want to say house. twit.tv/MH for more episodes of Maxwell's House if you're interested in finding out about all the wonderful aviation related topics he's covered, and additionally the color episodes before that. So much wonderful information. Thank you, everybody. Stay tuned till next week.